Shit, man, is that Seeger? Yes, I believe it is. A little Seeger for you, baby. Slam Pick Podcast, your boy, your host, Josh Ricardo. I'm here. Very excited this week. It's been a good week. Good because I'm talking to you and I'm breathing. I'm upright. It's another day, keeping it real. But also because my guest is a really good friend of mine. He's a fellow Italian. He's a fellow Ital. I'm actually Sicilian, but whatever. His name is Sal D'Amelio. He's a good friend of mine. I've known Sal for about 10 years. Sal's based in the Detroit area from the great state of Michigan. And he's a comic out there. He's also an actor. He's been in a couple films. Sal's like one of those, he really embodies that Midwest type of attitude. Just like decent guy, kind of guy that I'd pick you up for the airport and not bitch about it. Like that kind of person. It's rare to meet people like that, especially for me, because I live in New York City, and to get people to do you a favor, you either got to be really famous and really successful, or they really got to like you. And I feel like when I'm in other towns, I get to see how most people get to react. Not shitting on New York. I think New York's a great place. It's the greatest city in the world, in my opinion. I'm so happy that I'm a New Yorker. But at the end of the day, I realize some of the challenges that we face here in New York City are not the challenges that some people outside of New York City face. Therefore, it sometimes allows them to be a little bit more forgiving and a little bit more giving from that perspective. But also, let's be real. If you're in a town, I don't want to talk all the time. I mean, it's not about being rude. It's more about, like, I don't want to hear about your whole fucking day. That being said, Sally Boy and I went out when I was headlining out there. He basically was looking the whole weekend, and we did some great partying. The dude's an older dude, not old like an old man, but he's older than me, and he can still drink and hang. And my last night, I did a little too much damage. We're going to leave it at that. Sal was good enough to make sure that I was all right, and I appreciate that, and you're going to love him. So without any further ado, give it up for Sal. I'm a lucky dude. Everyone knows this. I'm even luckier today because I have my boy on, my family, my paisan, Sal D'Amelio. Sally Boy, say hello to everybody.
How you doing, Josh?
Okay, so usually I have really attractive women on the show. It's usually the audience goes on because they want to hear me talk to hot chicks. But in this case, I have someone whose soul is so hot, it's so attractive that they're on the show. Comic Sal D'Amelio. I'm so happy we finally got to do this because we've been talking about doing it for fucking ever. And now I finally got you. So to give everybody kind of a little intro about Sal. Sal is a really well-known comic in the Detroit area. And him and I met years and years and years ago doing a show. I actually was just out there hanging with Sal, and we had a wild weekend. And we were talking about doing this. And now we finally are. I have him on Skype. So I'm pumped, man. You pumped?
Absolutely, man. So good. And I had a great time this weekend with you, man. That was a lot of fun last weekend. And thanks for coming out.
We killed it.
It's great to be on your podcast, man. This is awesome. Right?
So I want to kind of start from the beginning about people. So what's really interesting about Sal, in my personal opinion, is that you embody that Midwest kind of attitude where you're like a decent dude. But at the same time, like, you don't take any shit. And I think that's an interesting balance because I feel like in society today, we are so separated. Like, generations are so separated now because of technology. I mean, literally, Sal and I, it took us 20 minutes to get the Skype working. Like, we're so separated because technology moves so fast. Now, you being in the comedy biz for, I mean, well over 20 years, right?
Just under 20, 19. Yep.
And you started a little bit later in your 20s too. So you're like, you've been in the game. You've seen it change significantly.
Correct.
When you were coming up, you probably watched, like I did when I was growing up, a lot. Like, I mean, remember in the early 90s how the comedy circuit was oversaturated. I mean, you could be doing comedy for 2 months and get on TV. That's correct. Really not the case now. I mean, back then, I'm sure it looked like, you know, an actual career could be possible, right? I'm talking about like mid to late 90s. It kind of shut down, but between 90 and 93.
Yep. Well, I started in 96. And when I started, I remember all the veterans that were in town saying, Dude, you're coming into this thing at the wrong time. I made more money in 85 than I make now. And these were features that were making 1,000 a week, and now they're making 300 a week. So I was getting a lot of negativity when I started, and I'm like, I don't give a shit. It's what I want to do. You know, I don't, it's not about the money right now.
It never is in
And
the beginning, right? I mean, not to cut you off, but just to the audience, just so they know, a feature act making 1,000 a week right now in this day and age is bananas. Depending, I mean, obviously it's all depending on who you're opening for, and that's all up to the headliner. But I headline like B, C plus rooms right now. That's where I'm at in my career, and 1,000 a weekend is generally like kind of around what I would take. And
sure.
I'm doing 20 more minutes than the feature. I'm eating the check. The people are paying to technically come see me. So for that in 85, being someone making 1,000 a week and having the gigs, and they're only a middle act, that's pretty fucking crazy, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to guys that were flying to Houston, getting their airfare paid and making $1,000 as a feature. And because there was no comedians back then, there wasn't a lot of comedians. I mean, obviously Leno and all those guys made it great, and comedy clubs were opening up all over. But there wasn't a lot of open mic comedians back in 83. If you were a com if you had 20 minutes back then, you were a 1,000 a week comic. You have 20 minutes now, you might be lucky to MC, you know,
You might be able to
somewhere.
make 1,000 in a year if, I mean,
Yeah,
the
yeah.
thing, I think what's interesting, and I think what I want to point out to the audience, because this is in my, I mean, I'm a comic, so obviously I think all things about comedy are interesting, but I think from the layman's perspective, what people don't realize is that you see Comedy Central and people think that's, oh, that's what comedy is, but they don't realize there are hundreds of dudes that are making a living off of stand-up working really tiny markets. And we're not talking just Chitlin' Circuit. I mean, everyone's heard of that with black comics. We're talking middle of the road, nobody, you live in a demographic that isn't conducive to making your career take off on television. But it was so funny when we were hanging out, Sal and I went to a bunch of little spots in the Detroit area, spots that no one's ever heard of. I mean, I think everyone knows, you know, the Comedy Castle for the most part, because a lot of big names go there. But for all intent and purposes, the surrounding area is filled with rooms. And you
Right.
make your living off of those rooms. I mean, and there's comedy to be had, but no actual format to take you off. People have to move to bigger markets, then you lose your money. So for a guy like you, right, doesn't that become kind of a situation when you're like, well, what the fuck do I do? You know, I'm an older dude in the sense of, not that I'm an old man, but I'm older in the sense I can't just bail, right?
Yep. You're absolutely right. That's exactly it. I mean, I've even talked to some guys that moved to New York. And when they come back to work here, and you obviously you know more about New York than anybody, but these guys come back, and you probably can attest to this. They say, "Sal, man, I used to be here. I get 45 minutes at your room. Now I'm doing 7 minutes at Dangerfields. I mean, that's all I'm getting is 7 minutes, 9 minutes. You're so lucky. You get to hone your act there. You get to do 30, 40 minutes. You know, so it's a lot different. I'm sure you can attest to that. When you move to New York, you're not getting the 45 minutes unless you're on Fallon or something like that. You're not going to work the cellar and get to do 30 minutes and shit. Even those guys or you yourself, you probably get 10 minutes at a club on a Friday night.
15,
15 minutes,
15 to
yeah.
20 if you're 15 to 20 if you're accomplished enough to for a club to respect you to give you that kind of time where you're moving along. But like you said, I mean, it's if you're on TV or you're moving and they know you, then you're moving up on the ladder, then yeah, you can get that out here, but you got to slit a lot of throats
Yeah.
to get to that point, man.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Let me ask you a question though. I mean, let's say, because we kind of talked, Sal and I spent a lot of time together this weekend, got to know him even better than I did before. It was amazing. It was like a really big, it was like comedy camp. It was really great. And in one of the car rides, I remember us talking about this. You could probably, you specifically, and let's make it kind of a general thing for the comics in your area that are working, you could probably sit there for the next 20, 30 years and keep making a decent amount of money being a road comic. Because you're
Correct.
building up your connections, plus you do run your own shows, which always helps with bargaining chips with other comics, and you're also a really great dude and really funny. So all those things are in your favor to keep getting work. Does a
Correct.
part of you say, you know, fuck, man, I wanted more out of this in the sense of, let's not call it fame, let's just call it an opportunity to appeal to a wider market as opposed to just around here. So like how, so what does that, how does that make you feel? Do you think like, you ever think like, hey, I want something more out of this and to be bigger? Do you ever think about that? Does it ever bother you?
You know, I do sometimes, and but you know what? When I don't know, like this weekend, I'm doing a show at the Holly Hotel. It's been around forever. Tim Allen started there. It's a restaurant in the basement. They do comedy. It's about 90 people. It's packed every night. I'll get four shows of 90 people. It's packed. And yeah, when I'm driving to that gig, do I say, shit, I wish I was driving to the Comedy Cellar in New York? Sure. But then after the four shows on the weekend, and I just have a great time, and I just love doing this, and I try new jokes, and they work, and I drive home that night, and I'm the happiest comic in the world, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. So, you know, sometimes, and then you see people leave town, and they do very well for themselves, and you think, geez, you know, maybe that could have been me. But you know what? I don't think of it that way. I don't know. I worked with a comic named Chad Daniels out of Minnesota. He never left Minnesota. He's been on Comedy Central. He's done Letterman and Leno and all those guys. So, you know, it's some people do it differently, you know?
It's really about perspective. Hey, Sal, move a little bit further back from your mic. There you go. Perfect. So I agree with you, and I feel like I'm not in necessarily that position because I'm still in New York, but I do see what it's truly about, and it's about, for me anyways, is being true to myself, true to my story, and being a part of the right revolution. You know, I mean, right now, like we've talked about this before, the masses don't appeal to me. And I've been trying to appeal to it, which is fake in itself, and I didn't even really know it. I was sitting there trying to do what everyone says I should be doing, and in reality, I need to be working outside the system. And I think to a degree, in this day and age, technology, as much as it has hurt the generation gap, it also gives us an opportunity to put out our stuff. And you know, a guy like Sally D in fucking Detroit, you could fucking get famous off of some shit that you never thought you could do. Some content you put online or something happens, and next thing you know, boom.
Yep, you're exactly right. Or you use another avenue, whether it's a great podcast or a serious radio program or a local television show here, or obviously you got the Last Comic Standings and America's Got Talent and all that stuff. And you could pop there. Next thing you know, you're headlining every improv, and you got the same act you had when you were headlining Holly Hotel.
Sure.
You know? So it's about the craft with me, you know, to be honest with you. I started doing stand-up because I loved it. I didn't start doing it because I wanted to get famous, you know?
Yeah. And people lose sight of that. And I think, you know, I think at the end of the day, if you can't figure out what your foundation is, or if your foundation's built on shoddy ground, you're gonna fuck up. But if you can figure out, like, oh, I remember doing this because I didn't care about getting paid. I wanted to be heard, and I thought I had a talent to spark an involuntary response, which is one of the hardest things in the world to do. And that really is what it breaks down to, right? That's the simplistic back to basics form, right?
Correct. No, you're absolutely right.
So what
You're
made
absolutely.
you, like, you're also an actor, and you've been in movies with Eric Roberts, and I mean, for the guy that's never been in a large market, you've done decently well from an acting perspective, you know? Because I mean, I remember you talking to me about the Detroit area and how, you know, a few years back it was kind of a place where the movie business said, hey, this is fucking pretty cool. And Sal drove me around Detroit, and he wasn't lying. I mean, you can shoot in the woods, you can shoot abandoned factories. I mean, it has everything you could ever ask for.
It really does. It really does. I remember reading articles about all these producers and directors that were coming here, you know, just loving the area. Up north is beautiful if you want to film that kind of scenery. It's really a great state for movies. It really is. And even with the no incentives and stuff, they still shoot movies here. You know, they, you
Really?
know, director, yeah, they still do movies here just because of the scenery and all that. So it's still got a little bit of movie making, but yeah, it's gone downhill since 2008, 2009, when I was doing a lot of stuff. But you know, hey, you know, it's a great market to be in. You can get to, what's really nice about Detroit, talking about just doing stand up is, you know, I can be in Chicago in 4 hours. I can be in Indianapolis in 4 hours. I can be in anywhere in Ohio in 4 or 5 hours. Cleveland, Cincinnati, Dayton. They all have comedy clubs, you know. So within 4 or 5 hours driving, you can work a ton of comedy clubs. And that's what a lot of people do, you
Yeah.
know.
Is that what you wanted to do? I think that kind of circles back. This is the river that flows in the ocean for us, is that my question is, like we said, you can make a living for the next 20 years off of doing stand-up without anyone ever knowing you. And that's a blessing in its own right. I mean, look at a guy like Brian Regan. He's more known now, but for a long time, he's a guy that only really comics knew, and then he made a huge following in every city he went in because he's really great at what he does. But at the same time, the guy can walk down the street without getting hassled, which is great in itself. But he also makes a lot of money, and he's known enough for being underground to make that kind of money, right? And you're a guy that's saying, hey, I could work fucking 30 clubs a year in the area I'm at. But you also have this thing where you're an actor. You know what I mean? And I don't – so what takes precedence over for you? It obviously, for your location, I'm assuming it's being a road comic. But if you had your choice, what would it be?
Probably – you know, and again, it gets back to what I just said. I would love – and we talked about this last weekend. I mean, I would love to be – like just one of these character actors that's just in the mob movies and
yeah.
You know, plays that same part. I'm not a Shakespearean actor. I would never tell anybody I am. I'm a 6'4" Italian guy, and that's what I would love to be, a character actor, because again, that would help my stand up. If you're in a couple of big time movies, next thing you know, you're working all over. So I think they both go hand in hand. But yeah, I would probably, if I had my choice, I would probably rather be a stand-up. I really would.
And I think that makes sense. I think what you're saying, and I think it's something that I agree with too, is that, you know, J.J. Dynamite Walker is making money off of Dynamite, and this is 40 years ago. He's still making six figures with stand-up. So if you get into something that's big enough for 10 seconds, you could have a stand-up career forever. You know, you could supplement, you know, that the acting just supplements the comedy. The comedy becomes the forefront, right? So you're saying, hey, if I can get in a couple of movies and I could be known as the guy who played Guido number 2 in this mob movie, you're fucking making bank, man.
I would take it all day long.
That's right.
I would take that all day long. It'd be great. just to have a little bit of a name and you get more work because it's a tough grind. I mean, I remember talking to Jimmy Pardo. I worked with Jimmy Pardo a couple of years ago. And I was just obviously just getting information from him, asking him questions and how he got to where he was at. He said, it's a very interesting story that he told me. He goes, you know what? He goes, I did Jay Leno on a Wednesday night. I did Jay Leno. I'm in front of how many people? A million people. Had a great set. The very next night, I did an Italian restaurant in Northern California for 10 people.
Yep.
The very next night.
That is stand-up, right?
Yeah, that's it. And I go, man, I never forgot that story. It's
because that's us in a nutshell. No one gives a shit about us. They really don't. I mean, you got to be huge. There are probably six guys right now that people hoot and holler and fawn over. And those dudes will be out of the mix in another 7 years. I mean, with the exception of a few of the mainstays, right? Like the Louis C.K.'s and the Jerry Seinfelds and blah, 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 what have you. And just to give you guys some insight, Sal and I did a gig together where they fucked us on the room. They put us in this fucking bar for 200 people. It had to be set up like a comedy club, and it looked okay, but no spotlight. Literally, we had to use a phone as a spotlight, and I had to go up and kill. We had to go up and do our jobs, and that's what stand up is, you know. And no one sees that, man. You know, around the country, they just think, oh, you go up, and I can do that. I can be fucking. No, you can't. Trust me, there's a small percentage of people that can do what we do, and you're probably not one of them. I'm going to let you guys know that right now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was an adjustment. Comedians adjust. I mean, I've done shows where the mic's gone out, and you're just screaming your jokes, and you make it work, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. Yeah, stand-ups, you know, you get again, I'm not trying to make fun of actors, but if a situation for an actor, I'm not saying any actor, some particular actors – if the stage isn't right or they forgot to put a couch where, you know, an actor might make a big deal about that. Well, I need that for my scene. And it's, you know,
sure.
Where a comic will go, fuck the couch. I'll fucking stand in front of it. No big deal. You know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. Actors kind of, I'm not saying all actors, but just some actors I've met, everything needs to be perfect. Where a comedian, it could go in hell in a handbasket and they got to adjust.
Yeah. Oh no, totally. So this is a good segue into what I wanted to talk to you about next. You work clean, and I love that. It's not something I'm particularly good at or I've ever wanted to be good at, and I've tried. It's something that obviously I'll have to do, or maybe I won't have to do considering the day and age. But I feel like when you picked up the comedy baton 19 years ago, that was like the thing to do because you wanted to be marketable to the late shows and to television, right?
I did. And a lot of the comics that I started out, again, a New York comic, one of my favorites, Nick DiPaolo. I remember working with him in 1997. I was 6 months in and I picked his brain and I said, "Hey, any advice, man?" He goes, "You know what? You want to get work, work clean. When you get 10, 15 years into it and you want to get a little dirtier because you're now a little bit of a name in your town and you're headlining and you want to go blue, you can do that at that point. But when you're hosting, I don't want a filthy, dirty comic in front of me, and neither does a lot of other comics that are going to come through town. So write clean, you'll get more work." I just remember that being said. And some of my favorite comedians of all time, obviously, are cleaner comedians. Although I love Richard Pryor and all those guys that were a little blue, but I did kind of gear towards, you know, the Rodney Dangerfields and the Seinfelds and the Brian Regans, and they all worked clean. So I kind of tried to write clean because of that. And once in a while, I do get a little edgier. I do feel that we all go through stages in our life where maybe we're a little more pissed off at the world, so we write about that, you know. Sure. We do change. But, yeah, you're right. I did start out writing a lot clean, and I got a lot of work because of it. I really did. And I see guys now, you know, I mean, I just saw it a couple weeks ago at the Ann Arbor Comedy Showcases. This guy went up, and he did, you know, this young black kid, and he did like 20 minutes on the N-word, and I'm just like, that guy ain't going to get any work. He's just not going to get any work, you know?
And I think what it comes down to and what I've been kind of working on in my own mind is that you play the game. You play the game because that's the way, you know, there's always a game, right? And if you want to be part of a business, you got to put your big boy pants on. You got to play the game. But you don't have to lose yourself in the long run. Like, if someone goes, "Hey, I need you to do a show for kids," I can do it because I have the muscle to go do it, because I've developed that muscle because I'm a professional. And I'm not going to lose – you're not going to dip your hands in my pocket and me lose out on money because you're saying I'm not saying what you need me to say, because I know I can do all whatever you need I can do. Point being, though, what I'm trying to make when I'm asking Sal about this, it's interesting because the audience may not know Sal, and you will when you follow him after the show's over. But Sal is not like – a school marm type of, like, a conservative dude. I mean, Sal cusses. Sal's a real dude. He's a real guy. He's not like some guy that, like, he's not, it's, that's not necessarily, it's his personality up there because he's telling jokes about himself. Obviously, it's true. It's about him. It's his outlook. Everything is pure. But the guy, like, he's a real dude. That's what's so great. He's like, you're a real dude. But when you hit the stage, like, that's your chosen path.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I know we've all been complimented off stage after our show. Obviously, you were great and blah, blah, blah. We've all heard it. But I've heard, and this makes me feel real good, I've heard like 60-year-old women come up to me going, "You know, I really liked you because you talk about everyday things and you talk about things that I experience in my daily activity." I'm like, that's great. That's the best compliment I could get, you know?
Yeah. Can you be a local celebrity where you're at? Like, is that – would that make you money? Like, I know there's a guy – I'm not going to mention his name. I know there's a guy in Connecticut that is an older dude, and all he does is kind of do Connecticut gigs, and everyone in Connecticut knows this guy. Like, he has a huge Connecticut following, and he doesn't necessarily change his act, but people still go and see him. Now, I remember you and I talking about this because you do so many shows in a very condensed area where you live. There's a lot of times where people have seen you twice. That's not unheard of, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there is, like you said earlier, there's a lot of like what we call one-nighters and bar gigs or restaurant gigs, and then there's the comedy clubs. And literally, I've worked, you know, Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle for a Thursday through Saturday, and then the following weekend, I'm doing an Italian restaurant in a basement about 10 miles away and from Mark Ridley's, and people will come out and go, "Yeah, I just saw you last weekend at Mark Ridley's. Oh, I saw that you threw a couple new jokes in this week. That's awesome." Just because I threw two new jokes in from what they saw last week was a big deal, you know, to
them. That might be a Midwest thing, though. I mean, here in New York, I even have people who are good friends of mine being like they're asking, they'll fucking ask me to come to a show, these mutts. And I'll be like, "Yeah, I'm doing blah, blah." And they're like, "You got any new jokes?" Like, who the fuck are you? You asking me to come out? I love how people think like new jokes just appear out of your ass when you ask it to. It doesn't work that way, you stupid fucks. I have people that have actually saw me 2 months previous. 2 months. Now, in New York City, if you can manage to get up a lot, which you should be able to do, in 2 months, yeah, I work hard. I could probably come up with about 7 new minutes. And that's a lot of new minutes. for a guy who's not, I mean, I'm not famous, so I'm not able to pop in everywhere and just start working shit out, okay? But for the fucking gall on these people, you got any new shit? No, but you know what I do got? Free tickets, because you're asking me. Get the fuck out of here. How about you pay for your ticket and the two-drink minimum? Everything will seem new to you then, because you're actually paying. God damn, I hate people. Don't you?
Oh,
I'm sorry. I don't hate everybody. You know what I mean.
It's so true. Look, we've talked about it with other comedian friends of mine. Stand-up comedy is the lowest fucking on the totem pole of the entertainment business.
It is.
You know? It's under fucking a cover band, you know?
It really is, which is ridiculous because it's the hardest out of everything. It's the hardest.
Oh, no. It's the Rodney Dangerfield of entertainment. No fucking respect for stand-up comedy.
You realize, man. Like, I've studied improv and I've been in improv troupes just because I wanted to have that on my resume and I'm decent at improv, so I took it up to make sure I had that, you know? And I've been in troupes and these fucking hipster types or these, you know, these millennials show up and they're so supportive with their fucking Pabst Blue Ribbon in their hand and they're cheering and they're laughing and they're quiet, they don't heckle. Meanwhile, those same types of fucks come to my show down the street at the comedy club and they're fucking on their phones or running their stupid fucking mouths. Like, I'm telling you, man, like, the world's fucked. It's ass fucked. Like, how – improv, you got a whole – improv's hard to do. Improv's not no slouch. I'm not saying that. But you have a team of people around you. You can kind of be silly and ridiculous, and you have a supportive atmosphere. I've never been to an improv show where people aren't at least paying attention, and that's at the minimum. I've been to – 9 times out of 10, you got to earn attention in the comedy shows I'm on. You got to earn that right. These people don't even give you that, even when they're paying.
Yep, you're absolutely right. I've watched a lot of improv. I've never done improv, but I've watched a lot of improv, and you're exactly right. I mean, you could be one of five people up there, and you're almost like, you know, I play a lot of baseball, so I use baseball analogies, and it's like, okay, you know, John isn't as good an outfield as anybody, so let's stick him out and right. Like the improv, you can put, hey, Johnny's not that funny. He's going to be one of the guys on the stage, but you know what? You're not going to get involved as much as the other four. You're just going to kind of have your couple moments,
yeah.
And that's it. You can hide somebody in improv. You can't hide anybody on stand-up.
No, it's a lonely fucking – it's a lonely world, man. You really die in your own arms to stand-up. And that's what I love about stand-up because I'm a darker individual – and I understand that, and I enjoy that. And that's why improv didn't appeal to me as much, even though I'm actually a working improv actor right now. So, hey, theater company, don't listen. But the reason why I love stand-up is because I can – the world can be seen through my eyes. I don't have to act like everything's roses and turn everything into yes and. I mean, that's the whole premise behind improv is you say someone tells you they're a fucking unicorn, you go, oh, you are, and your horn is so beautiful. Like, that's the whole point. Like, you have to agree with what your partner says no matter how ridiculous it is, or you're a bad partner. In comedy, you can be against the world, and if you're funny, people fucking listen to you.
Yeah, absolutely. God, so amen.
You come from a background where both your parents are from another country. They're both from Italy, right?
Correct. They're from Italy. I know you've heard me talk about them on stage a little bit. They're from Italy. Don't speak very broken English. You know, the 100-yard garden in the back and then Mother Mary on the front porch. I mean, it's, you know, we're New York Italians. I mean, we grew up in upstate New York when we came from Italy, and then we just came to Detroit because of the auto industry. But we're 100% blooded Italians. We, you know, eat at Italian food. My mom worked at an Italian restaurant for many years, never had to speak English. My dad worked in cement, never had to speak English. So we pretty much lived in Italy, except we're in America, you know?
Wow, that's amazing that you can – that a culture around that time could be that strong and have so many other expats coming into the U.S. that you're able to create a whole community where your parents really never had to learn English for the most part.
They really didn't. They really didn't.
Was that hard for you growing up? Because I'm assuming they raised you speaking Italian and then sending you off to school, right?
Correct. Absolutely. And I would go to school and obviously speak English to my friends, and obviously, and then I would come home, and I still do to this day. When I go to my mom and dad's house, I speak Italian to them. So that's why I've never lost. Now it's a dialect. I couldn't go to Rome, and I would be considered slang in Rome, but my parents understand me. And it's kind of funny because my friends would come over and I'd be talking English when we're in the car. And then as soon as we get in the house, I'm rapping in Italian. My friends are like, Jesus Christ, dude, what are you saying? Awesome. And the Italians talk loud, so they're thinking I'm getting ripped a new asshole. And I'm like, no, my mom just wants to know if I wanted any donuts, you know? I mean, you know, so it's just great growing up in that. And it helped for school, too. I would get, you know, maybe I'm in high school. I got, well, one time I egged the float. Me and about eight other football players, we egged the float. We got busted for it. Long story short, we're all in the principal's office, and they're like, this is 1985. And they're like, we got to call your parents. And I'm like, go right ahead. And they called my mom and dad. Shit, the principal was talking to my mom. She had no idea what he was saying. He hung up the phone all dumbfounded. Like, I think I just told her that you're expelled. And I'm like, yeah, oh, yeah, you did. I'll hear it from her when I get home. I got home. She's like, somebody called me today. You know, in Italian, it's like, somebody called me today. What was that? Oh, he was just calling you to tell you I got an A on all my classes. So it definitely helped.
I'm one more generation removed than you are, obviously, and from my Sicilian grandparents. And it makes me kind of sad because when my, you know, great grandfather came over through Ellis Island, he moved, just like your family did, he moved to Flint. He got in trouble over in Sicily, came over through Ellis Island. His brothers were already in Detroit, picked him up and said, you're going to work around here. And he found his wife and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, he got arrested a couple more times and then finally went straight and he had to get a job, you know, in America. So my grandfather and his brothers and sisters, they were all going to school and he needed to learn English. So forbade them, or whatever the word is. They were forbidden to speak Italian in the house because he needed to learn English. So only sure. my great-grandmother and him would speak Italian. So that's so great they taught you. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, it's self-taught, you know. It's one of those things where I had to. I had my mom and dad weren't going to learn English for me, you know.
Sure. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, because they didn't need to because they worked in industries where they're around other Italians.
Yeah, they're like, hey, learn your English because we want you to grow up and be a stand-up comedian making $300 a week, but you're going to talk Italian to us. So, you know, and they've lived a long life and they're still going strong, which is great. But that's why I've never forgotten how to speak it. So it's been a blessing as far as that goes, but it's definitely helped my stand-up. I love talking about them. I love talking about my upbringing and it's just, you know, part of who I am. I know I'm the typical Italian guy talking about being Italian. You know, I know Ray Romano made it famous and stuff, but it's who I am. Why not talk about it?
You're being true to you. So let me ask you a question. I feel this way sometimes, and I want to know your take on this. I am half Sicilian, half Hawaiian. My mother's Hawaiian. So I'm raised by two very strong cultures that do not relate one iota to white America. Even though I'm considered Caucasian, I do not relate to any white person I've ever met. And even though I'm a minority and I tend to relate more to minorities, I am not accepted within the minority community because I don't look like them and they presume that I have not faced the same struggles because of the color of my skin. I know you're in the Midwest and you're surrounded by a lot of other white people and you grew up in an era where, I don't know, maybe it was a little bit less separatist. I think now because of everyone having a cause, it's a very separate nation. Everyone's fighting for something. Even if the fight's ridiculous, they're fighting for something. Do you feel like you're an outsider looking in sometimes, especially when you were kind of growing up in your pubescent years?
I do. Well, and I think a part of what you just said is based on where you grew up, where you make your home. Like, for instance, for me, if I was maybe in – if I was in upstate New York, Binghamton, New York, where I grew up, if I was still there, it was predominantly Italians and blacks and then obviously whites. So you were one of the three there. Well, here in Detroit, I'm Italian, although there's a lot of Italians here, not many, not as many as like New York or Boston or something like that. But I grew up here. I'm Italian, but I'm really white because here is a lot of blacks and a lot of Arabic people. So if you're not Arabic and you're not black, you're white. You know, so I think it has a little bit to do with that, what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, did that ever make you feel like shit? Cause I remember, you know, wanting to relate to people in school growing up and I was the new kid quite often, which was a bitch in itself. But I remember, you know, seeing the other like Pacific Islander type kids. Like usually it's Filipino kids or Asian kids, and they didn't want to really deal with me because I don't look like them. And then I remember seeing like, you know, like maybe the black and Mexican kids who kind of grew up the same way I did, kind of poor and, you know, not having much and having kind of crazy family members. And that I related to that, but to be accepted was so difficult. You almost feel like you're alone because I look like I'm three different things. I look like this white kid, and then I'm raised by these two loud brown cultures that could care less about mainstream America. I mean, literally, you're eating fucking pasta fasool, and the next day I'm eating a fucking roasted pig. I mean, it's a weird world I'm from, and it really makes you be alone. And maybe you weren't as alone because your parents were Italian. They probably knew other Italians, but you spoke a different fucking language. You have no relation. You're not Olive Garden Italian. You're a real deal dude from, like, your fucking family's from Italy.
Yeah. No, you know what? I don't think I ever felt that as much as you, because I think maybe your situation is you're Hawaiian, but you really don't look Hawaiian. So I guess my question to you is, did you grow up and never tell anybody about your Hawaiian part? Did you hide that?
No, I couldn't, because I was raised in that culture. I speak Pidgin. I can sing songs in Hawaiian. My grandfather's dead now, but speak Pidgin English, which is the dialect there, which is now considered a real language. So I'm considered bilingual, everybody. And this is truth, because my friends would come over and my grandfather would start to talk to them, and they couldn't understand a word he was saying because his Pidgin English is so thick. Because Pidgin English is have all this Hawaiian phrasing in it amongst the English, because the English – Captain Cook settled Hawaii, so we picked up random English phrases that we throw in with Hawaiian phrases, and then with that's standard fun. English, it's all fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny you just said that, because we do the same thing. Like when I talk to my mom and dad, I'll talk half English, half Italian. I'll literally be speaking Italian, and then I got to throw a couple of words in English because I don't know the word in Italian.
Give me an example if you can remember one. That'd be really funny.
I think when I was growing up, I'm like, ma, you voy, you know, do tri gumbanya me des she scop but Michael Jordan shoes. You know? I'm trying to tell my mom that I want Michael Jordan shoes, you know, but how the hell am I going to say Michael Jordan in Italian? You know?
That's fucking incredible. I really hope that's a bit, because that is priceless. That is amazing. Oh my God, Michael Jordan shoes.
Yeah, you know, trying to explain to her while, you know, and obviously she's taking me to Kmart where there's no Michael Jordan shoes. So I didn't get them. I got the $15 heads or whatever the hell.
You got the Pro Wings. So this is interesting, because I talk to a lot of comedians, obviously, not only in work, but on the show, and different people who have taken the path unbeaten, if you will. Your parents probably, I'm assuming, and also I kind of know a little bit because we know each other, but they come from a background where I remember you telling me a story about your grandfather coming over from Italy over like 40 times just for the work, and going back and forth on a boat just for the work for 2 months. And he did that an obscene amount of times to bring money back. So you come from this hardworking Italian background. I mean, it's the epitome and the picturesque of immigration at the time. I mean, your parents worked their asses off, right? And now they have this son that they brought to America, or they have in America, for better opportunity. And they're hoping that you probably go to college, which I know you did. They're probably hoping you become, you know, a professional person, which you are. But at the same time, you're this fucking comic. Did they, when you said, I'm going to try this, were they supportive, or did they even know what you were talking about?
They were very – my mom is like – my mom tells jokes at the Italian – she's 89 years old. She still sits around and tells jokes. I literally got my humor from her. My dad's been laughing at my mom's jokes for obviously 100 years. And I feel like when I started doing stand-up, and like you said earlier, I started later in life. I went to college. I played baseball. I had other aspirations. And stand-up, I was a fan of stand-up, but yet I wasn't doing it. And then when I started doing it at 29 years old, I started doing it. I don't even think I told my mom and dad for the first 6 months I was doing it. And then just one day I'm sitting around eating pasta with them, and I said, I'm starting to tell jokes at these clubs around town. And they're just like, wow, that was just fantastic. And they started telling all their friends, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And I think getting back to what you said earlier, they are. My dad was a hardworking guy, didn't make a lot of money, obviously did cement work. And he was telling me about how much money he used to make in like the 70s and stuff. And he would work literally 50 hours a week digging ditches. I mean, hard work, harder than anything me and you have ever done. Yeah. And his check would be like $120. So he would do all that. And then here I am working a freaking gig and I'm getting paid $200 to tell jokes for 45 minutes. I just sit there and go, Jesus, man, I'm blessed to be able to make money with my mouth, you know? So,
yeah. Oh yeah. And we bitch and moan. I mean, I bitch and moan a lot. And sometimes I have to slap myself with reality like that. Cause I come from a background where my dad would throw bags for 50 hours, 60 hours a week and have his back ripped apart at the airport. And he did okay. But not like, I mean, I'm making his paycheck sometimes for 2 days of work, which it's few and far in between. You know, I wish it was more, but at the same time, I can't hate the fact what we're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. I take it into perspective all the time. I never think, oh, I mean, granted, these, like you mentioned, like these guys like Louis C.K. and these guys, they're making obscene money. God bless them. They got to really look back and go, holy shit, you know, look at the money I'm making. But even at my level, I think it's a lot of money because of, you know, if my mom and dad were doctors, I'd be sitting here going, why the fuck am I doing stand-up? I'm making $200 a show. My mom and dad are doctors. I should have went into doc. No, I don't have that background. I got hardworking parent background. So my $200 gig is a fucking lottery, man. Yeah.
Of course. Now, let me, when your parents first see you do stand-up, how long into you invited them to see you do your show?
I think it was a couple years, maybe a year or two, and they came out. They actually came out to Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle. My cousin from New York came out, and I picked a really good weekend. I was just hosting, and I did my Italian stuff. It's one of the first stuff I wrote, and it was great. Probably, you know, and then I've done some gigs with my mom and dad in the crowd where I just fucking ate it, and that kind of sucks. You know,
it's like, that is the worst, man. You know? But, I really hate those gigs when I have to invite family. I really hate it. I much rather perform for nobody, like nobody I know. I just really hate when people like go, I want to come out. And a lot of people always want to come out. Because then you go, now I got to make them feel special. Now, because they are special. Now I got to put them in a special seat. Now I got to make sure their bill's taken care of. Now I got to make sure they – I mean, now I become like I'm a promoter. And like I just want to show up and do my shit, have a couple drinks, get the fuck out of there. That's all I want to do.
Yeah, I thought I was the only guy that thought that sometimes. I can't stand when I know people. I appreciate people coming, but at the other, like you said, I just want to get my craft in my head, and I'm not thinking about, like you said, seating them and making sure they're comfortable. And I agree. There's something to be said about that. That's interesting.
Fucking ridiculous. So before we wrap up, I wanted to just touch on one more thing. I am about to get married, as the audience knows, soon. And I waited a long time, and you waited a long time to get married as well. And it unfortunately didn't work out. But I want to know from you, just because I've been talking about obviously taking this leap, and the audience knows about the sex addiction I went through and a lot of stuff, a lot of the issues I have. You don't necessarily have those issues, but I want you to tell them whether or not you think that being a stand-up affected your marriage and affects relationships.
It does. It really does. I don't care what anyone says. When you marry a stand-up comedian, if your significant other is not a stand-up comedian, it is tough. I don't care what anyone says. And almost unfortunately, a lot of comedians are divorced, you know. Yeah. But the ones that make it, the ones that have long-standing relationships, I believe the woman or man that's not the stand-up understands that person's career, understands it really, truly does. And my wife did when we first met. I met her at a comedy club. We were married 5 years. She helped me run my little fundraiser room. She supported me on the road. But one of the things she said to me towards the end of our relationship was, I thought you were going to change, meaning I thought you were going to want to be more of a homebody, or maybe get off the road, or maybe try to do something else if it's maybe be on the radio and not have to travel, or do something in entertainment but not do the stand-up. She said, I thought that was going to be a fad, and she goes, I was wrong, and I'm sorry for thinking that. You were definitely right. You told me this is what you wanted to do. So I think a communication up front is the greatest thing that two people can have, and I believe talking to you last weekend, your fiance understands your career, and I think you guys are going to be great, man.
Oh, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me coming from you, man. I really respect you know, not only your opinion, but also your insight, because you've actually been through it. I think I relate to what you're saying, because I, the previous relationship, the woman said something similar to me. And at the time, granted, I wasn't making a whole lot of money at stand-up. There wasn't like success coming down the road. Now I think my fiance goes, oh, this guy brings in a large portion of dollars into this household through acting and stand-up. This is what he does, you know, sure. And she loves what I do. And I think I've done everything I can on my end to make sure I have somebody that understands that. But like you said, if that communication isn't as clear to the other person as it needs to be with our career, I mean, that's bottom line shit with any relationship, no matter if you're a fucking, you work in a carnival, but yep. Especially for stand-ups, that's the thing, man. You gotta have somebody that actually supports the fact that you are not, I mean, my girlfriend spends a lot of Friday and Saturday nights alone. You know, correct. You can only go to so many shows. My fiance can only go to so many shows. And most of the time, I'm going there to work. It's not like it was when I first began stand-up, where every fucking show was the show before I'm a star. You know how you're like that idiot where you're like an open micer and you're like, the next show after this will be HBO. Like, I mean, it's not as exciting as it used to be, because now it's work. Now it's my craft, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And for your listeners out there, you are a good singer. Your wife will always believe me. You are, because I'm going to tell your audience, we did spend a lot of time last weekend, and we went to a couple different places. We went to a comedy club and just hung out. Then we went to like a dance bar just to kind of hear some 70s music. And then we went to a karaoke bar, because you're like, hey, I want to go sing. So we went to this place called O'Malley's. It's in Livonia.
Great O'Malley's. Karaoke bar. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got Josh up there. There was a line of people singing, but the bartender got him up. Well, he blew the doors off the place, and I actually stopped over there a couple nights ago. I had to go meet somebody there real quick, and that girl was there. I think her name is Angel, and she's like, hey, is your friend coming back this weekend? He was really good. I want to hear him. I said, no, he's in New York, but I'll make sure he comes back, Angel. She didn't forget you. So
no, that kudos makes me, that's to
you
amazing. There,
brother. Your wife's always going to be able to hear you sing in the shower. God bless you.
Sal was my fucking, basically my beacon of entertainment. He was the greatest dude in Detroit. I'm going to tell you guys a story. You've heard it, because I'm going to do it in the intro about what I did in Detroit. But he was like, you're like family to me, man. I love you. Seriously.
Absolutely, dude. You're a talented guy, a good guy. And I'm glad I met you, 10 years ago at Joey's. So, man, I can't wait to do your show again. And good luck to you in New York there and in your future, man. I just wish you the best. I think you're a huge talent. And I think it's gonna come across very soon to the rest of the country, bro.
Oh, I thank you, man. I feel the same way about you. And there's no reason to talk like we're never gonna see each other again, because I'm gonna be up your ass. You now can never get rid of me. I am your little brother, and it is on.
Awesome, bro.
Plug where you're at. I want people to go follow Sal, and I want them to know everything about you. Let them know.
Well, thank you, man. SalDemilio.com is my website.
Spell that for them.
Sal DiMillo, S-A-L, D as in dog, E, M as in Mary, ILIO.com. Got all my videos on there and where I'm going to be. Also, Sally D, O-A is my Twitter.
Spell that.
I'm on Facebook, Sally D, S-A-L-L-Y-D, 08. And like I said, my website, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook. All you can find me just Googling my name. But I'm going to be obviously I'm working the Holly Hotel this weekend. Really cool little comedy club. And it's actually near Flint, where your family's from.
Nice.
And then I'm going to be in Maryville, Indiana, over Memorial Day weekend. If anybody's near Maryville, Indiana, at a place called Wisecrackers. And I'm doing Burroughs Comedy Club June 10th and 11th, which is out near Brighton, Michigan. If anybody's near Michigan, come out and see me. I'd love to see some of your listeners, brother.
Yeah, I would love it too. And I'll make sure they get the word, and they go out and support my man Sal. Like I said, man, I love you. Thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate
absolutely.
It
absolutely. Thanks for having me, Josh. Thank you so much.
That's Sal, Sally D, and the place to be. Go follow him on Twitter. He's not great with technology, so make sure you follow him and write stuff to him, and he'll figure it out. I kind of like watching him struggle with it, so please blow his Twitter up. Make sure you go check out his gigs as well. The guy's playing everywhere. He listed just a few of them. So make sure you go to his website and see where he's going to be. Sal, if you're listening, man, thank you so much. You're a great dude. You're my dude. Your family. I've said this before. I love you. You're the best. Also, you can always get a hold of the show, slampigpodcast@gmail.com. Write me an email. I'll read it on air. Also, you can follow our handles at slampigpodcast on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also look up the show on Facebook. For me, it's always at Josh Accardo, A-C-C-A-R-D-O. You know that already. Come on. And I'm on all the stuff. A lot of cool things going on, stuff I can't really say yet, and I hate when people do that, but that's just reality, just so I keep you in the loop. I'm hoping to continue what we're doing here on a bigger scale, and hopefully that happens soon for us so we can all be part of this revolution that we're creating. All right, everybody, hope you're having a good rest of the week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and as always, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
I woke last night to the sound of thunder. How far off I sat and wondered.